Good afternoon, Sonoma County and the world. The time is 4 o'clock p.m. Pacific Daylight Time. This is KOWS LP Cows Radio, broadcasting live from Occidental, California, at 107.3 on your FM dial and streaming live on the web at www.kows.fm, bringing you the Mystical Positivist for the next 2 hours. Cows Community Radio thanks Mini Rivers Books and Tea for their generous support. Mini Rivers specializes in tools for spiritual practice, including books, candles, and sacred art. Mini Rivers carries fine loose leaf teas and teaware. They also host spiritual talks and classes. Mini Rivers is located at 130 South Main Street in Sebastopol. You can phone them at 707-829-8871 or visit them on the web at www.miniriversbooks.com. Cows Community Radio thanks the Sonoma County Gazette for their support. The Sonoma County Gazette is a free monthly newspaper with a print and online circulation estimated at 100,000 and is distributed to newsstands, coffee shops, restaurants, and various stores countywide. The Gazette covers local news as well as social and environmental issues. Their calendar highlights local classes, meetings, art events, and entertainment venues. Visit them on the web at SonomaCountyGazette.com. Cows Community Radio is membership supported. Everyone who works here is a volunteer committed to the love of originally sourced community radio, but there are real operating costs to keep this station on the air, and we are committed to expanding our coverage throughout West Sonoma County. We have a project right now we're working on to move our antenna from the hills behind Occidental to the ridges between Occidental and Sebastopol, so we get better coverage in downtown Sebastopol and Forestville and Grayton. And we're hoping that you can help us with this project. If you go to www.kows.fm, you can find out how you can help support this program and help support local community radio. You are listening to The Mystical Positivist. This is your host, Stuart Goodnick. This week on The Mystical Positivist, co-host Rob Schmidt and I converse by telephone with Dr. Michael Changaris, a clinical psychologist and a Zen practitioner with a specialty in the biological bases of behavior, stress physiology, and the neuroanatomy of PTSD. He completed his postdoctoral fellowship with the Child, Family, and Adolescent Intensive Outpatient Program with Kaiser Permanente. He continues to deepen his own practice through his work and his relationships with family. We'll be discussing Mike's new book, soon to be published, called The Neurobiology of Health, Healing, and Human Connection.
We'll get started with that conversation after a short musical break. You'll be listening to the fourth movement, Bourré, from Georg Philipp Telemann's Sonata Discordata in A Major, performed by the ensemble Rebel, from a CD entitled The Sunday Sessions Wish List, music from St. Paul Sunday. Thank you.
This is The Mystical Positivist, a radio show dedicated to the application of reason in the pursuit of spiritual practice and development. It consists of commentary, book reviews, interviews, and discussion in and around the local and larger spiritual community. The thesis of the show is that rationality is in no way the antithesis of deep mystical experience. In fact, we assert that it is a necessary ally. This is your host, Stuart Goodnick. Joining me in the studio is my co-host, Dr. Rob Schmidt, director of Taoyuan Meditation Center and co-founder with myself and Jim Wilson of Many Rivers Books and Tea in Sebastopol.
Great to be here this day after a blue moon.
Our guest today by telephone is Dr. Mike Changaris, a clinical psychologist and a Zen practitioner with a specialty in the biological bases of behavior, stress physiology, and the neuroanatomy of PTSD. He completed his postdoctoral fellowship with the Child, Family, and Adolescent Intensive Outpatient Program with Kaiser Permanente. He continues to deepen his own practice through his work and his relationships with family. He is a member of the steering committee of the Conscious Family Festival, which is one of the ways that Rob and I have been able to get to know and appreciate his quick intelligence, his copious energy, and his generosity of spirit. We'll be discussing his soon-to-be-published book called The Neurobiology of Health, Healing, and Human Connection. Mike Changaris, welcome back to The Mystical Positivist.
It's so good to be here with you, Stuart. I'm really glad to get to talk with you and share with your audience.
Well, we're really glad to have you back, and we're glad for the occasion for this conversation, which is the, very soon-to-be-published book that Stuart just mentioned, The Neurobiology of Health, Healing, and Human Connection. But before we get into the book itself, I sort of wanted to start by talking for you to provide a context for listeners to understand your clinical psychology background and maybe even your Zen practice background and how those have influenced the creation of this book and the direction of your work.
Pretty deep question to sit with, and it's a great question. The book is aimed at this idea that human touch is one of the foundations of what it means to be alive. And you know, touch is one of those places where we connect most fundamentally with the world itself. And even if you look from at the very beginning of where human life comes from, human life starts in physical contact. The very first touch to develop in the womb, or the very first sense to develop in the womb, is physical touch. And one of the things that I found through my own practice and learning to find a sense of stability and peace and openness in my own life is that it's actually not about a retreat away, but it's about a learning to meet life really. Literally at the edge of where my skin becomes, you know, in contact with this world. When people have these kind of transcendent experiences, oftentimes they say they've been touched by something. There's something has touched them. And I can remember one time after a long sit, and I was working in the Esalen kitchen, and I just touched the board that we had been cutting on. And in that very simple but intimate contact, brought me into this feeling that everything in this world is connected and okay. And that sense of transcendent state is something that happens a lot through touch, because touch is a wordless knowing. Sometimes when I have, you know, like looked in someone's eyes and held their hand, there's a kind of a connection that can't be encapsulated in words. And how this relates to my understanding and my passion about, you know, human psychology and development is that the core field of psychology has forgotten that touch is the foundation of human life and has made the ability to be in contact with another person oftentimes such taboo that people who are meant to help us heal oftentimes have no idea what does it mean to really be in physical contact with the people they're healing.
Yeah, that's certainly my understanding of the position that most psychologists Western psychologists would take. So I wonder if you could talk about how that, I mean, it's funny because you're a clinical psychologist and this is sort of a clinic, it's a clinical understanding of how not to touch. And I'm wondering if you could talk about how that developed in the field and what it is, you know, talk more then about what you're challenging in the field.
Yeah, you know, I mean, at its very essence, I think at the very beginning of our field, it started off with our, you know, with Sigmund Freud and probably, you know, Genet before him. And they started in the Victorian period, and there was a certain set of moralities that were happening in the Victorian period that would have made physical contact, or even maybe, you know, seeing the skin of another person sometimes to be anathema, you know? There was a guy in the late 1890s who was reported to be, you know, one of the, I can't remember his name right now, I wish it was on the tip of my tongue, who was reported to be one of the kind of the preeminent parenting guides. And his instructions to parents were, you know, shake your child's hand once or twice a year, but anything more than that will ruin your child. And so that was the era that psychology grew up in. And you can imagine that that because of that, a man of Jewish descent in Austria may not have been really allowed to be alone in the room with another person, and oftentimes a woman, in physical contact at that point. And so, particularly considering the history of what happened almost, you know, kind of mid to aftermath of Freud's life, you know, in the Nazi era. So I think there's kind of this been this Victorian morality that has come forward. But yet, you have a guy like Ofer Zur, who sat on the ethics committee for the APA, who in some of his writing on touch will say something like this. It's, you know, touch is one of the most foundational parts of our own health and our healing psychologically. And there are sometimes to not touch is actually the most unethical act a psychologist could make. And this is somebody who is, you know, working very hard in the field of psychology to help them, you know, build an ethical psychology.
Well, when
and
did...
So as, yeah, go on, sorry.
No, go ahead and finish.
Yeah, and so as he's doing this, one of the things that's being challenged in the field is those old notions, those old Victorian notions that just got set up and are carrying forward, when really, in fact, the more we know about human attachment, which is one of the foundations for what creates health and psychology, we know that it starts in the wordless connection of physical contact.
Got it. So you mentioned Zur and Ofer Zur and his work, and so when did this context that you're pointing to, the Victorian era, the cultural context of the Victorian era, sort of being assumed into the body of psychological knowledge and research? When did that begin to be challenged within that body of research?
Well, you know, it's kind of interesting. I mean, that's such a lovely question. It's kind of interesting because almost in the immediate aftermath of Freud's work, everybody else started to challenge him. Maybe that's the mark of a good leader, a good founder, is that all of the people that he supported found their own way of doing the work itself. But no one does psychology like Freud did. Freud would often not even look at people. He would have people, he would sit behind them on a couch where they couldn't see them, so he could be a blank slate. You know, one of his students, Carl Jung, who really worked at this idea of, you know, the psycho-spiritual transformational process that happens in psychological development, he shifted the focus of psychology to just pure projection, where it's all about this one, the kind of term we sometimes use as the monad, the individual by itself, to being in a dialogical process or a dialogue. And so how Jung did therapy was he did therapy face-to-face. And he sometimes would joke that, you know, therapy is also a social hour. It's also a way of connecting. So even at the very beginning, but in the last maybe the last 10 to 15 years, we've seen, the last 20 years, we had the cognitive revolution of psychology, which started to look at how thoughts impact our mind and our body and underlie, you know, many, many psychological conditions. And this has led to great treatments from psychology where I can say right now for mild to moderate depression, it's psychological or psychotherapeutic interventions are much better than medicine, about equal for severe depression. But in the aftermath of that cognitive revolution has come this revolution in understanding how our emotions or our feelings actually are an integral part of what it means to be human, what it means to be alive. And so some of this new understanding about the role that touch plays in our development comes out of attachment theory and comes out of our understanding of how emotional intelligence grows in people.
Interesting. I also am kind of curious because you're also, besides an active in the field of psychology, you are a ardent Zen practitioner and have been for many years. Is there a parallel evolution you've seen in the modalities of spiritual practice in which touch may have not been so included and may be changing?
I hope so, because I think it's vital, and I think there are a lot of spiritual traditions that use touch in a much more kind of concrete way. Some of the spiritual traditions that include movement have used touch more in a focused manner than Zen has. I do koan training, and one of the areas in koan training is you learn these stories that kind of help another person wake up. And there's only really one story in the koan lineage that is focused on touch, and it's about 10 bodhisattvas standing on the edge of a cold body of water and leaping all at once into this body of water. And as they touch the water, the immediacy of the contact with the water itself kind of wakes them up. And so although Zen does not always point people to physical contact with each other, it is almost always physical contact with the felt experience of being in body.
Mm-hmm.
Even when Dogen uses a line like the falling away of body and mind, where there's this kind of intimacy that happens with you and everything else in the world, there's a very deep sense that it's an embodied intimacy, that you're in your own skin while you know your own skin is not where you stop.
And in a sort of, also in the modern world, there's a body of work. I think it's somatic therapy. Am I using the term right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
And are you familiar with that? Because it seems like that carries the same theme of trying to ground one's experience in the felt sense of body as a primary experience and a place to return to.
Absolutely. And in a way, even the word felt experience, which we sometimes will use in common parlance these days, actually came out of one of the early somatic therapists, Eugene Gendlin. He studied with Rogers. Did a lot of looking at. He would listen to these tapes of therapy sessions. He's like, I can tell. I can tell when somebody is in a moment of transformation or when someone's actually changing. And he could listen on the tape and he could hear it. And out of that, listening and watching and kind of watching outcomes in therapy and doing a bunch of measurement and science, he found that one of the key factors was what he called focusing, or this ability to kind of track the felt experience and have it move forward from these kind of stuck patterns. So the systematic psychology at its root kind of comes out of this humanistic kind of process. And then you have somebody like Bessel van der Kolk, who started out a very traditional psychiatrist, and he studied with a guy in the 70s at I think it was Harvard or one of the Harvard Boston medical school, and his teacher would say to him, your patients are the only textbook that you really need. And from that kind of instruction, he actually founded the field of traumatology, understanding that PTSD is a thing. And over his course of personal transformation, he went from looking at things from a very psychological and biological mechanism, looking at the chemistry that's going on in the brain, to really understanding the deep personal and body-based transformational processes. I have a study of his from where he struggled to get it published for a while that looked at a comparison with EMDR, which is a therapy for trauma, CBT, which is a more traditional therapy for trauma, and yoga. And he had struggles getting, even with his name, he had struggles getting it published because of the yoga and the EMDR component. And he found that, in fact, yoga does transform it. And so he will oftentimes send people to massage therapists, so that they have this felt experience of being in contact with another person. Because oftentimes, there's a sense of deep isolation that happens in trauma. So there's a movement even within the kind of the mainstream field to this sense of the body, as Bessel van der Kolk says so well, the body bears the burden. that actually has gone on, and this is at a fundamental genetic level. You know, if a rat pup is licked and groomed in those first 12 days of life, it has an entirely different gene expression than a rat pup that doesn't. You know, it's quite profound.
And there's been plenty of books in the last 20 years to point out precisely the same sort of phenomenon for human, you know, infants and children as well. You know, the way that, for example, the infant heartbeat will sort of synchronize with the mother's heartbeat, and that sort of thing. And absent that, the physical difficulties that can arise in the body later in life when that sort of connection is not forthcoming. So
I totally agree. You know, it's like there's a great studies that look at a kangaroo touch. Kangaroo touch is one of the things that they have skin-to-skin contact immediately after birth.
Mm-hmm.
And you'll see that, you know, when a mother is holding the child up and the child is nursing, that when the child's body temperature drops a degree, the mother's body temperature will raise a degree. And one of the most profound studies that I found when I was researching his book, it just kind of blew my heart open in my mind in a very deep way, was a mother who had twins was nursing both twins at once, and you could actually track when one twin was going down, that side of her body would go up. And when one twin was going up on the other side, her body would regulate down. It would regulate her temperature differently on different sides.
Wow.
based on the twins' needs. To me, there's something so deep about that. It's just awe-inspiring.
Really? That's amazing. I didn't know about that one. that's great. Well, so So there's as we're alluding to here, a lot of research which discusses the crucial importance of connection through touch at an early age, that is, you might say, being touched, even perhaps more than touching. But touching has to be, and you've already made this distinction, but touching also is going to be something that's that becomes very important as we mature. So talk about that distinction between touching and being touched, and how that is articulated in your book.
Yeah, I love that. I found myself kind of falling into the mystical as you were doing that. There's a kind of a one of the classical Zen questions is, does the sight go to the eye, or does the eye go out to meet the sight, or does the sound meet the ear, or does the ear go out to meet the sound? And so there's a way where, you know, all of our senses, they meet at this place of perception and being perceived kind of co-occur immediately.
Mm-hmm.
But touch is a little bit more obvious. In order to touch somebody, there is always a reciprocal being touched back, and one of the things that I think we as a culture have lost is, how do we build healthy touch into our lives? What does it mean to have, you know, reasonable and good and safe contact? Like, some of our fear about, you know, safety around kids and family and all of these things have led us to not know even how to have safe touch, but how to teach children about what red flags are for physical contact or what safe contact is. And so because of that, oftentimes we end up being a culture that doesn't touch very much. I know this is slightly off topic from what you'd asked, but Tiffany Fields, who's this great researcher in massage out of Florida State University, she had this interesting study. It's only implicative, it's only correlational data, but she went around and looked at the rates and the kind of touches that happen in a culture and the amount of violence. And she was able to correlate the amount of violence that a culture has with touch deficits.
Wow.
And in an American culture, people tended to not touch each other very much. And when they did, it was either when she watched teenagers do this, her research assistants, because she's published hundreds of studies. So when their research assistants would watch, they would see the teenagers in America would tend to both have instrumental touch, which is the kind of touch that's aimed at doing something, or aggressive touch to create contact.
Right.
A lot of pushing, a lot of shoving. Right. Whereas if you were in a culture like France, is a lot more kind of nurturing touch, a lot more kind of kindness within the physical contact, you know, those kinds of things. And so, you know, the nuances of what touch is actually quite deep and profound and has a big impact. So if you look at medicine, you know, in general, people need physical contact when they're ill, but most of the physical contact they have when they're ill in a hospital setting is that mechanistic or that instrumental touch. But interestingly, it changes the level of meaning and sense of connection for both, you know, the care providing staff, the nurses' staff, and the patient, when the staff shift from doing that instrumental touch to doing a more connected, more caring type of touch. So, you know, you may be moving somebody's leg, but instead of moving it like it's a piece of meat, as one woman that I worked with in a nursing facility would say, I feel like I'm being moved like a piece of meat, you know, to moving it with a sense of intention and an awareness, an awakeness to the connection that's being created by the hand on the leg and the two people sharing this very kind of close and intimate space of caregiver and cared for.
Well, that resonates really strongly with my recent experiences. My father went through his dying process a few years ago, and you know, he was in and out of various care, you know, hospitals and rehab places and whatnot, and he also, you know, had developing dementia, and I'll tell you, he was incredibly sensitive to the qualities of touch of the people in these various facilities, and had a lot of anger when he felt like he was not being. I mean, he interpreted it as not being respected, and I think that's right, and yet. I think it's also fair to say that it's the heritage of what you're calling instrumental touch as being this common form of connection in our culture. That's probably the reason that people get into doing that, you know, in terms of caregivers and that sort of thing. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Oh, it totally does. And I mean, I think we have this lineage of not knowing how to make contact with each other and feeling often really awkward with it. And when somebody has, you know, has an Alzheimer's or another form of dementia, which is an area where I spent a lot of time learning to do work, oftentimes when words are gone, the felt experience of human connection that happens to touch can be quite profound and quite deep. I mean, I have a lot of stories from working in facilities. You know, one of them that grabs me was I was sitting in kind of the aftermath of a group with somebody as she kind of transitioned to going to dinner. And she didn't really want to get up and go. And, you know, the staff in this particular facility tried to let people be moved with at their own pace. And so I was just sitting with her because I didn't have anywhere else to go. But she couldn't say much, but she grabbed my hands in this very profound way, kind of made this eye contact, and you can feel that we're connecting, and there is a recognition of each other, and in this kind of shared space that most people in the West only know through sharing space verbally, but we were sharing it in a nonverbal way, and that physical contact was the kind of the resonance that allowed that to happen, and you know, and after that, you know, she gets up and we walk. You know, and she goes to dinner, but it's in that brief but very profound moment. I mean, of course, for me, I remember it so deeply because the connection was so profound and also how much connection is meaningful. So when I look back at my memory Rolodex, I couldn't tell you logically why that memory is so profound and so etched into my heart. But in that attachment level and that nonverbal level that any parent knows when they look into the eyes of their child, you know, there's a sense of a kind of wordless knowing that happens. And I'm hoping, and this is kind of one of my passions and dreams, is that as we move forward, that maybe we can actually heal as a culture and how we do these types of touch, because it really is not rocket science. And in facilities, oftentimes people would rather be doing the more caring touch, but either they don't know how, or the environment pushes them out of it, or just the sheer stress of every day. sometimes also there's an intimacy that happens with caring touch. Mm-hmm. And when you're caring for people on an ongoing basis, unless you're fairly grounded in your own practice or have a way to reconnect, you can sometimes lose your sense of self. And so I think sometimes people, you know, touch in a more mechanistic way to keep distance from one another.
Hmm. That's an interesting observation, that last one in particular. I hadn't thought of that. But of course, it makes perfect sense, given that, you know, people in various facilities will be maybe touching a lot of people, having to touch a lot of, you know, individuals in a single shift. And so that can lead to, I'm sure, some kind of need to withdraw.
Right. You're listening to The Mystical Positivist. This is your host, Stuart Goodnick. This week, our guest by telephone is Dr. Michael Changaris, a clinical psychologist and a Zen practitioner with a specialty in the biological bases of behavior, stress physiology, and the neuroanatomy of PTSD. He completed his postdoctoral fellowship with the Child, Family, and Adolescent Intensive Outpatient Program with Kaiser Permanente. He continues to deepen his own practice through his work with his relationships with family. We are discussing Mike's soon-to-be-published book called The Neuroanatomy of Health, Healing, and Human Connection.
So one of the things that occurs to me to ask you that was sparked by this last interchange is since you expressed the wish that our culture will heal, I'm wondering... You know, psychology is a discipline intended to heal. Usually, I think it's configured as individuals and not more generally. So, how can psychologists participate in the healing of a culture in this way? I know your book is obviously an attempt to help effectuate that. Is there another way to think about this in terms of allowing this understanding of the crucial importance of touch to permeate our experience?
Yeah, I love that. It's such a deep question. I had one of my mentors when I was coming through graduate schools, one of the founders of the trauma division of the American Psychological Association. And I think, you know, the trauma division is a nice metaphor for what's possible in our culture, because in the mid-70s to early 80s, the idea that PTSD was a thing didn't exist, and people had no idea. And so after the aftermath of, you know, Vietnam, people came back and had no care and very little support for this both physical in the sense of brain impact, but also psychological impact of having both the moral wound of sometimes inflicting damage on others, but also the psychological wound of witnessing the horror of war. We had no, as a field, we had no way to articulate it, nothing to do to treat it. So there was this big hole where trauma was, and so people would be called all kinds of diagnoses that didn't fit. And so as this knowledge came in, now, you know, 20, 30 years later, we have, you know, the VA is spending more on trauma therapy than in almost any other place. So my mentor would say, I remember one of these early speeches I went to of her, she said, as a therapist, you have to look at which level you're going to work, you know, and there is the societal level and this kind of governmental and these systems level work, and then there's local systems level work, and then there's organizational work, and then there's kind of the personal and interpersonal work. And I feel like, you know, the change has to come at those levels. And so, you know, things like being able to, you know, train doctors who see their patients on how to create a sense of connection through physical touch. You know, like a simple factoid, like, you know, medical providers that shake their patient's hand and look them in the eye after they ask them to take a medicine, they have a much higher medication adherence rate. You know, and that's a 3 second, maybe 5 second, maybe at most 15 second intervention. And in a field that's been really pushing to get things done faster and quicker and tighter, if you can actually increase medication adherence with such a small thing, it can have a very, very large impact, and let alone creating a better quality of the relationship between the medical workers. So then one level would be kind of training and teaching and helping us learn. Another level is at the level of an individual practitioner. So if I'm a family therapist and I'm seeing a couple that's struggling, I know that if I help them increase the amount of safe and loving touch, it will actually, even if they're like light brushes, hand on the shoulder, kiss on the cheek, you know, brief hugs during the day. If I prescribe little hugs and little kisses, and they have to do 5 to 10 in a day or something like this, I know that the quality
which, is in your book, by the way.
Yes.
I'll just throw that in there.
there's
instructions in doing that, just that, in your book.
Yeah,
so.
And I try to put together some kind of practical instructions along with some understanding of how touch plays across the lifespan, because, you know, touch is kind of an understudied sense in a way. You know, it's like people are very aware of how a lot of things play in their life, but they have very limited understanding that touch matters past infancy. You know, we know, most people know that if an infant doesn't have the right amount of touch within the first year of its life, oftentimes that infant will die, like literally
die
from a disease called wasting. But, you know, we can touch deprivation as adults too. So men, after they've had a divorce, if they don't have a lot of physical contact in their circle, they're at much higher risk of getting depression than if they did.
I think death rates are higher too, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, absolutely. There's this line of research on loneliness that I find so profound. There was a meta-analysis, and I wish I could mention the number, the N that was in the study, because it was huge. It might be like 300,000 or 200,000. There was a big N in the study.
Mm-hmm.
And they looked at loneliness, and the authors, after reviewing all of these studies and putting their effect sizes together, you know, probably 100 studies or at least 20, they made this conclusion, which I found to just be another one of those jaw-dropping conclusions, which is that the lack of the feeling of being isolated and alone is as big a risk factor as hypertension or diabetes or cardiovascular disease for early death. It's as big a risk factor for anything else, and we don't do anything about it. So, but being in physical contact actually can really, as long as it's safe and loving contact, can really pull us out of a sense of isolation and aloneness and into real contact. So, you know, it's really quite profound what touch will do. So I spent a lot of time working with people with frontal temporal dementia and Alzheimer's dementia, where at some point the level of ability to be in relationship changes, but the longing for being in contact doesn't. And so being able to kind of foster so sometimes I would sit with families who are and teach a family member, which I actually have a feeling that you probably already knew this, teach family members how to be in this kind of wordless contact with somebody and recognize the relationship that's happening. Because oftentimes the family member, the grief of the change in their family member would, let's say a son or a daughter, the grief and the change in their parent would end up blocking them from having what quality of relationship is actually possible. And there was a quality of relationship that was possible. And being able to kind of work through the grief and then being able to recognize the relationship when it was there, oftentimes nonverbal, oftentimes physical touch. I even taught one wife how to massage so that she could, you know, massage her husband and have some sense of this kind of real physical but safe physical intimacy, you know, as she was going through his process of living with frontal temporal dementia.
I'm curious if this these findings extend to an individual with oneself. So in other words, we were talking earlier about felt sense or simply redirecting attention to the body, as opposed to where most people's attention typically hangs out in this society, which is in their cognitive functioning. And does that show a similar kind of effect and reduction of stress? And then sort of on top of that, are there methodologies of self-touch in the sense of like just intentional touch and feeling of oneself and just activating that sense that also has a therapeutic effect?
Yeah. You know, and interestingly, at a biological level, if I touch somebody else, I increase the love and bonding hormone, as long as it's safe and connected touch, the love and bonding hormone of oxytocin.
Mm-hmm.
And I also call online this area of the brain called the orbital medial prefrontal cortex, which regulates emotion. So when I have physical contact, I actually literally am lighting up the areas in my brain that have to do with emotion regulation. And part of those particular areas, they're kind of the higher order emotion regulation. It has to do with recognizing my internal felt experience. So the more I have some of this physical contact, the more I gain in some sense of my body awareness. And Tiffany Fields has done some lovely stuff with looking at people who suffer from anorexia, who suffer from trauma. And one of the things that she finds is that the regular massage actually increases, in psychology we use this term, interoceptive awareness, or the ability to kind of be aware of your felt experience in your body. And so she found that by doing these kind of physical touch and safe physical touch on a regular basis, people not only gain in the awareness of their body, but they gain in something that's, I think I'm actually going to block on the term of art, but it's a very, it's not just body awareness, it's what it means is the acceptance of their body and their relationship with their own physical self. So the physical touch actually helps people feel better and safer and more whole in your body.
Right.
So the question
I was asking is, you know, the examples that you're giving is still the you know, the touch experience that I have is mediated or involves touch of other or other touching me, and I guess what I'm trying to get a sense of is it a necessary component for some of these physiological effects and psychological effects to have touch with another, or is there some body of work that shows that simply a practice of putting my attention on my body, feeling my senses, you know, more actively, and even perhaps, you know, as I'm talking, I'm sort of like pressing one hand with the other hand, you know, and being aware of touching myself in that way. Does that have a similar effect, or is it a much more reduced effect because it doesn't involve other?
You know, as the scientist in me hears that last question and knows that I don't have the answer to whether it's a similar or a different effect, but that it does in which brain areas and which neurochemistry and all those things, but both of them do have a profound effect. Self-touch really does matter, and thank you for clarifying the question. I run a lot of groups, and I regularly sit in groups of people who have pretty severe trauma and teaching some skills for how to be with oneself. And you know, one of the things that often comes up is, as people are telling a story, you can see in the felt experience they're getting into that fight or flight zone. Mm-hmm. And in that zone, the muscles get tight. The body gets prepared as if to defend itself, you know? And so one of the things that I'll sometimes do is, you know, I'll have the person move out of this sense of, you know, it's a global feeling, to kind of being able to track where do they feel the feeling in their body at this moment. Right. And as they do that, I might have them kind of put their hand over that area, providing physical support, and then put a little pressure into that. And that pressure, what that deep pressure does is it calls in the proprioceptive sensations that actually trigger the body shifting from that fight or flight state to what's sometimes called the social engagement or the rest and digest state, or the biological term would be the parasympathetic nervous system. Mm-hmm. You're shifting over into that. And what it allows to do is it's kind of like the body becomes a container for the experience, and the touch itself begins to soothe. And interestingly, our parasympathetic nervous system, much of that sense of rest or our nervous system that gives us a sense of peace, is actually reading our current body state and then telling us whether we should be stressed. So if I've had one of those days where my shoulders are up to my ears, my brain stem will start to look down and says, oh, yeah, your shoulders are tense. There must be a reason that you're tense. And then my cognitive mind will then start to scan to look for reasons that I'm tense. But if I do a little supportive touch on the outside of those shoulders and do a little rubbing of those shoulders or give myself some physical contact, oftentimes they'll drop. And so when I have my hand on my chest, what's happening is I'm actually triggering the parasympathetic nervous system to kind of look and say, oh, wait a second, this is not as threatening as I thought. I can soothe. I can come down. Mm-hmm. And this is why somebody like Temple Grandin, mm-hmm. the woman who's kind of famous for her great work with autism, who has autism, right. she would use these kind of deep pressure touches to kind of help herself feel more soothed, because particularly in it's which nerve fiber and how it travels up, because there's kind of four big sensory pathways, and one of them gets more information into the brain faster, and those tend to be related to the deeper kind of sense of touch. So, yeah, and in a very profound way, touch is affecting some of the fundamental neurobiology that allows people to shift. But then if you put your hand over an area, the internal experience, the felt experience of living with that contact is one of feeling supported, of feeling contained, the feeling sometimes that it's not as overwhelming. Hmm. And so, yeah, I will definitely teach these skills to people, and I think I might have done some version of this at least four times this week, you know. And, you know, if someone has, and not this week, but if someone has had, you know, domestic violence, or someone has had, you know, experiences of being, you know, of being in a situation of being, you know, like a car accident or surgery or being hurt by another person violently, oftentimes, you know, these feeling states that are worthless and terrifying will come in, and being able to kind of give somebody something physical can help them contain that experience, tolerate it, and move through to a deeper sense of peace and ease.
Got it. You know, one thing that was coming up to me in this description and this discussion relates back to modalities in spiritual practice, and I'm familiar in a number of traditions variations on the practice of returning attention to the body, particularly as a way or a strategy for disidentifying with particular psychological states. And in fact, the practice is very similar to what you were just describing, of being aware of or asking questions of, where does this feel in my body? You know, does it feel hot? Does it feel cold? How big is it? How small is it? And it's a way of sort of separating the cognitive from the actual feeling sense in the body. And once one can focus on the feeling sense and put attention on the feeling sense, the body is very responsive. It's that feeling sense can begin to move, or the energy bound up in that experience can begin to move and to shift and to process. Whereas when the attention's on the cognitive state, the energy in the body seems to be stuck. And I'm interested if, particularly in your work with PTSD, if that kind of sensibility, that kind of practice is something that's become an effective way of dealing with people that have strong trauma essentially ingrained in their bodies.
Yeah, what a truism that is. I think it's, you know, at so many levels. You know, oftentimes when someone has faced trauma, they can, one of my early supervisors, she said that when someone's faced a traumatic event, they have a rupture of the basic denial that we have that the world is always safe, you know? And we go through this life that the world is safe. Like, after this call, I'm going to walk into a building, and as I walk into the building, I could die, literally, you know? And when you've had trauma, you know how fragile life actually is. And so part of the growth in trauma is oftentimes has, even in people who are more secular, has this almost spiritual feel of learning to accept the unacceptable and move into a place of peace despite the fact that there's danger. It's that we're safer than we know, even though there's danger. So even though, yes, it's possible that I'll die on the walk into the building, the bigger truth is that most likely I won't. And on the way in, even there, even in the midst of this difficult and oftentimes challenging life, there are these moments where I'm contacting the world, and in that contact can be such sweetness. My toes in the grass as I walk, the feeling of the wind on my cheek. I can remember one time in early meditation practice where I felt for the first time in years the wind on my face, and I'm like, oh, this is some mystical and magical thing. And then I just realized that I'd been so disconnected from my own body for so long that I hadn't felt that. And this sense of disconnect from our body is a cultural wound, but it's also something that happens in trauma. And so if you look at the way that our neurobiology connects up, is that we can be in this logical brain, which tends to be related to kind of the left prefrontal area. And that left prefrontal area has to connect over to the right side of the brain and then down through the right anterior cingulate, right insular cortex, and that insular cortex is what reads our body and gives us bodily sensation. And many times when people have trauma, the term of art sometimes is called alexithymia, or the inability to recognize the felt experience of our emotions and put language to our emotion and even know that we have it. And so people will feel numb and deadened on the inside. So I've worked with people, and also it's very common for people to come back from war, and they have a child or maybe two and their wife, and they see the child and their wife, and what's supposed to happen is a welling up of the heart when you recognize somebody that you love. And instead of that happening naturally, there's the deadening from the numbing that happened from the trauma. Mm-hmm. And so they look at someone they love and they feel this numb, disconnected, not in their body sense. And so being able to kind of help, and that leads them to make an interpretation that maybe I don't love them. Maybe I'm broken. Maybe I could never love again. When in fact what's going on is their body is in a state where they can't read their body sensation so easily. But over time, we come back in contact with the body, but not until we build resources, because for many people, the experience of trauma means the body is a threatening place. So oftentimes we need to build the capacity and the resource to be able to be and inhabit the felt experience of this moment. And as we build those resources and that strength, then we can move through it. So there's a big movement somewhat in some of the spiritual communities. I know Spirit Rock is doing a lot of work on this, and there's some other Zen groups that are doing it, of being able to help the teachers or the meditation practitioners teachers be able to know how to help people with trauma that have to go through a slower arc in. Because sometimes just sitting and bearing witness to the body isn't enough to help people move through. In fact, for some people it can be re-traumatizing and overwhelming. But when you know how to kind of begin the process of this slow titration of recognizing the felt experience in the body, then you can start to move towards healing. Hmm. So there's a Zen teacher, kind of beloved Zen teacher from the Korean tradition, Sansa Nim, who he would have, for some of his students, he would start them off with chanting, which itself kind of stimulates the vestibular system in the gut to start to read that the body is safe and in the here and now, which, like I said, that it turns on that parasympathetic nervous system because in this moment the trauma is not happening anymore. And they would also start them with chanting and bowing. And that chanting and that movement allowed some people to then to kind of inhabit their body more, so that when they would do the sitting meditation, they'd be able to have more contact. And some people would go the opposite direction. They would be in contact with their body and through meditation and mindfulness first and include the other pieces. And both of them are great tracks. I've talked with Jim Wilson a bit about this at different times, and also with other people in his kind of training circle. Mm-hmm. So I think there's a really good dialogue that can happen between some of the meditation traditions and psychology and what we're learning. And I hope the dialogue continues, because the truth in psychology has gotten much richer for the mindfulness practices. Some of the mindfulness practices these days are the most evidence-based, most solid treatments. In fact, this year, mindfulness-based cognitive therapy just surpassed medicine for treating depression and also relapse rate after depression. The mindfulness-based therapies are really transforming how psychology is done these days.
Oh, that's interesting, and I think I want to talk more about that in the second hour. But right now, I just want to bring up something that was coming up as you were talking earlier, which is related to a guest we interviewed previously on this show. His name is Amos Clifford, and he does something called Shinrin-yoku, or forest bathing. And I was thinking about that from what you were saying, but also from some of the stuff in your book about, for example, indigenous healers in contact with, say, trees or plants, or in other words, physically touching, sometimes physically touching, sometimes not necessarily physically touching. Parts of the natural world, like these living plant beings that we live among and sometimes intellectually take for granted, I think. And I'm wondering if there's Mr. Clifford was telling us that this forest bathing, which is basically going into a forest or natural area and spending a lot of sort of slowing down for Americans, slowing down, simply being present to being in this natural context, touching, smelling, the various trees and plants, etc. Even at the end, I think they brew a natural tea from some of the plants at the end of one of these sessions. And I'm wondering if that aspect of touch, that is touching the natural world, is something that is beginning to get recognition as well, in addition to something like mindfulness.
Wow, what a very deep and profound question. And I think that, I think it definitely is. And it's quite profound. It is quite profoundly healing, being in contact with the natural world, many indigenous healing traditions have some version of physical contact or touch that's woven into them.
Mm-hmm.
And being able to kind of see the healing mechanism that's present within some of these traditions is quite powerful. But yes, being in contact with the earth and being in contact with the world itself is quite healing. So Francine Shapiro, when she was developing EMDR, she talks about the first time that she discovered EMDR was actually walking in a natural setting.
What is EMDR?
It's a trauma treatment called eye movement. I actually, for some reason, my name is blocking. So basically, eye movement desensitization, mm-hmm. and the R I just dropped for some reason.
Mm-hmm.
My poor brain today. Lost a few words today. What she was doing was she was in tremendous stress in her life, and she was walking through the woods and happened to see this tree being blown back and forth. She's either walking in the woods or looking out her office window. I've heard the story both ways, and I'm not sure which is right. Was looking at a tree being blown back and forth. And as she watched this tree being blown slightly back and forth by the wind, she noticed that she took a deep breath, and she came in contact with herself again and settled down for the first time in days. And from this, she realized there's something about this movement, about this watching, about this seeing the natural world that really kind of calls people out, and created a therapy kind of based on that. And it's been it's got good evidence behind it. It's solid. I know people debate it in the field, but it's got good evidence behind it. But yeah, there's a lot of an awareness that if you want to find your place, you're going to find it through your physical contact with the planet and with the natural environment. I often look at what we're doing to our planet, and I think if people were actually settled, if they're in this social engagement system that we oftentimes get in when we're in the natural world, when we're in contact, when we sit on the ground, when we feel the tree, when we hear the birds, if we're in this kind of more settled place, would we be able to be as damaging to each other and to the planet? And I don't think so. I've noticed, that things that in my past, kind of growing up in kind of a, the Bible Belt / heart attack belt of the country, where there wasn't as much of an internal awareness, there are things that I would have taken for granted about my impact on the world. But now I can really see with a more empathetic eye, because I'm in a state that knows that the tree and I kind of share a similar place in the environment. We both are valuable to this place. So I wouldn't treat it with the same level of disrespect.
Got it.
I might still use it, but I wouldn't treat it with the same disrespect.
Well, we will continue this theme after our break, but it's time for us to take a short break here. You are listening to The Mystical Positivist. This is your host, Stuart Gudnick. This week, our guest by telephone is Dr. Michael Changaris, a clinical psychologist and a Zen practitioner with a specialty in the biological bases of behavior, stress, physiology, and the neuroanatomy of PTSD. He completed his postdoctoral fellowship with the Family, Child, and Adolescent Intensive Outpatient Program with Kaiser Permanente. He continues to deepen his own practice through his work with relationships and family. We are discussing Mike's new book, soon to be published, called The Neurobiology of Health, Healing, and Human Connection. Stay tuned for a continuation of that discussion after a break. The time is 5 o'clock p.m. Pacific Daylight Time. This is KOWS LP Cal's Radio, broadcasting live from Occidental, California at 107.3 on your FM dial and streaming live on the web at www.kows.fm. Cal's Radio thanks Studio E for their underwriting support. Founded in 1983, they are located in Sebastopol and feature a recording, mixing, and mastering facility with a full range of production services. Their facility is also available for special events. You can reach them at 707-823-5316 or visit them on Facebook by searching for Studio E Music Production. Cows Community Radio thanks Fuse Glass artist Valerie Adams for her support. Valerie offers unique functional Fuse Glass art, gift items, interior design accessories, and custom artwork at Modern Fuse Glass. Valerie also provides hands-on class instruction and individual mentoring. See her work online at FuseGlassGallery.com or follow her on Facebook at Modern Fuse Glass. You can reach her by phone at 707-539-4400. Elder Salon is a wisdom discussion for Transition Sebastopol and meets every fourth Thursday at 6:30 p.m. at the Sequoia Village Co-Housing Common House, which is located at 459 Sequoia Lane in Sebastopol. Upcoming meetings are September 24th. And for more information, visit transitionsebastopol.org/aboutElderSalon. Cows Community Radio is membership supported. Everyone who volunteers here is doing it out of the love of community radio, but we do need financial support to help keep the station on the air, to replace equipment, to improve equipment, and to move our antennas so that we can have a better receptivity in some of the population-dense areas of West Sonoma County. So we invite you to become a member of the herd. Go to www.kows.fm and find out how you can participate today.
So we need your financial love as well. We'll return to our conversation with Dr. Michael Changaris after a short musical break. You'll be listening to a piece by an anonymous composer called A New Tune, performed by the Palladian Ensemble from a CD entitled The Sunday Sessions Wish List, Music from St. Paul Sunday.